Okay, folks, we're all set to get ourselves on the way here now in lesson number 4 in our series of studies entitled Biblical Earth Science and Astronomy. Take your Bibles and turn once again to Psalm 104, and it might be wise to have a finger in Genesis. Sometimes you're better off with two Bibles, but I don't know if you ever noticed that or not. If you got two Bibles, you can have one open up to one place and one open up to the other place. If you don't have two Bibles to deal with, or three, it might be wise to also have Genesis chapter 1 at least bookmarked for you. And we're also going to need Job 37. Job chapter 37. While you're doing that and turning there, let me take our sheet off the board here. Put that aside. I left our diagram as it. Well, I'm getting tangled up in my cord here again. My leash, maybe that's what I should call this thing. It really is that. I left the diagram as we had it at the end of our last session. And once again, we ended up talking about the open firmament of the heaven, what we might call our atmosphere around the earth there. For now, we'll call it that. What I'm calling the closed firmament of the heaven, even though the word closed isn't used once again back there in Genesis, it's evident from talking about the realm which the birds fly, the fowl of the heaven fly, is the open firmament, that the rest out there was considered closed. Really, folks, off limits to man. And you know, my understanding of that really hasn't changed. And it may sound kind of strange to say that man shouldn't be out there and shouldn't be spending any real time trying to get out there and things like that. That won't sit too well with NASA enthusiasts and so forth there. But when I talked about the barrier God put up there, the wisdom in all that, there are some things out there in what we call outer space, the closed firmament of the heaven out there, that since man hasn't got the capacity to deal with it, he's better off staying out of there. And there's some real danger for him out there. And, well, I'll let that go at that for now. Time may permit us to say some things along those lines later. But outside the realm, therefore, of creation, there's God's realm, the third heaven, the heaven of God, where he dwells with a great number of things out there, as we'll eventually see here. The third heaven where God dwells is not a vast wasteland, nor is it an unreal place. It's not unreal estate. There's real estate out there. God's estate out there. And as we ended up seeing last time in 2 Corinthians chapter 12, where we got our Pauline nomenclature, first heaven, second heaven, third heaven. Paul was caught up into the third heaven. That's just telling he's caught up into God's realm, outside of and outside of the realm of creation, the heavens and earth we know about and they can see. But he was also said caught up into paradise. That's a particular place there in the third heaven. And there's a lot of places to the third heaven, just like there are places and chambers and everything to the closed firmament of the heaven, the second heaven. It's fascinating how that even in the open firmament of the heaven, climatologists, meteorologists, and so forth, they're able to come along and say, you know, it's kind of like there's layers in this thing. And you get the ionosphere, the troposphere, and the stratosphere, and so forth there. I don't know if I got those in proper order or not, but they're there. There's kind of like a layering effect they recognize there. I mean, that carries on out there. And there's places, identifiable chambers, and tap, and all that kind of stuff. Same occurs out there in the third heaven where God dwells. And like I said, we'll have reason to deal with some of those things as we progress on here. But that's where we left off last time, and now we need to start adding a few more things here and filling in some of the blanks and rounding out our appreciation for the simplistic structure of the universe, of creation, that we need to have so we look at things as God does, so we in our mind's eye, we understand and appreciate things as he does. It can deal with further descriptive terminology that he uses when it comes to activities that take place out there and things that go on out there and things and features that are out there, and also on the earth. And a part of, therefore, this issue of biblical earth science and astronomy. All right, I had you open up, like I said, once again to Psalm 104 here. What I'm after is just a reminder, who stretcheth out the heavens like a curtain. All right, and the issue now, and the issue in the passage here, and the issue we've been examining so far, is that the light of God's red let them penetrate through. Here we are on the earth and everything, and while it's daytime on our section of the planet and everything, light reflects once again up and down throughout this open firmament of the heaven there, and we don't, and we're bathed in light, and it's like the realm of darkness doesn't even exist. There's some significance to that also. I hope I'm not tiring you with telling you that there's significance to all these things without being able to go into them at the present time, but that's what we see during the daytime, and when nighttime even comes once again, we're able to look out and see the vastness of that closed firmament of the heaven there, and we realize that there are light-bearing bodies out there, but they don't produce enough light once again to illuminate that realm, so we see really anything going on out there. We have an appreciation for its vastness and everything like that, or we think we have an appreciation for its vastness, but once again, we look at it and we don't see the light of God's realm. The curtain effect, once again, is preventing it, the light from coming through, and we don't see it. Now, I want to add one more concept to the issue of the heaven and the curtain and an effect it has, especially to us, on the inside of creation. Come over to Job chapter 37. Job chapter 37. Now we'll be looking at Job 38 again in just a few minutes here. My plan and purpose, or my thinking anyway, is to have us begin to focus upon the earth and make some progress here with respect to the earth itself, beginning in this hour, and we'll see what we do, and hopefully we'll be able to do that. Look at something that is said here in Job 37. Elihu is the speaker here, and he's talking about the greatness of God as the Creator, and he says an awful lot that's good. An awful lot that is in perfect alignment with God's eternal power and Godhead and everything. But he's still not providing Job the counsel Job needs. Unfortunately, the three other characters and even Elihu here end up darkening the counsel, the knowledge that they're providing Job with. The Lord says there to Job, "Who is this that darkeneth counsel by words without knowledge?" Once again, Job needs counsel. Counsel comes by words. But the words have to be in line with the knowledge that's appropriate for the counsel. And all these guys have been talking about some things, and some things they say about God are right. They also say some things that are incorrect. But they say some things about God that are right. And what we're going to look about here with Elihu and talking about what God created and the magnificence of his creation and some features in it that he's recognized and appreciates, and that Job didn't come along and say, that's not right. Job recognized them also. Job knew them. Elihu is correct in these things, but it's still not the counsel Job needs. Anyway, pick it up in verse 14 here. Job 37, "Hearken unto this, O Job, stand still and consider the wondrous works of God. Dost thou know when God disposed them, and dost the light of his cloud and cause the light of his cloud to shine? Dost thou know the balancings of the clouds, the wondrous works of him which is perfect in knowledge? How thy garments are warm when he quieteth the earth by the south wind? Hast thou with him spread out the sky, which is strong and as a molten looking glass?" Now, that's the expression there in verse 18. Let me do something here very quickly. Okay, there's a switch on this microphone cable, and every once in a while I bang it. And the last thing I want to do is inadvertently turn off the mic. So I just double checked on that to make sure I hadn't done that. Anyway, verse 18, "Hast thou with him spread out the sky, which is strong, and as a molten looking glass?" Now, Elihu talks about the sky here. Our first thinking about that, of course, is the atmosphere right around our earth. The planes fly up there in the sky. We look up into the sky and we see the clouds and everything. And granted, Elijah's been talking about clouds and so forth here. But he actually goes beyond that in what he's saying in verse 18. He says, "Hast thou with him spread out the sky?" Now that's, hold your place here in Job 37. Come over to Isaiah and chapter 40. Isaiah chapter 40. Isaiah chapter 40 and verse 22. This is a verse we're going to be returning to, and probably near the end of this lesson, if not in the next lesson, because it is a fascinating and extremely important statement that God makes here to Israel when it comes to his design and purpose for the earth and creation as a whole, but the earth in particular. And we'll get to that, but I don't want to make any comments on that right now. Anyway, verse 21. "Have ye not known? Have ye not heard? Hath it not been told you from the beginning? Have ye not understood from the foundations of the earth? It is he that sitteth upon the circle of the earth, and the inhabitants thereof are as grasshoppers, that stretcheth out the heavens as a curtain," is that constant again, "and spreadeth them out as a tent to dwell in, that bringeth the princes to nothing, and maketh the judges of the earth as vanity," etc., etc. Here. We got the issue once again, the stretching out the heavens as a curtain. We're familiar with that. But there was, when we were in Job 19 last time, I told you you got the stretching out and the spreading forth issue. I believe it's Job 9, excuse me, in Job 26 there. You got the stretching out as the curtain, which we've been focusing upon. Then I said you got to remember he also spreads them out. All right, they're stretched to function as a curtain, and they're spread out also. And in connection with spreading them out, he garnishes the heavens and decorates them once again with the stars and everything. Well, in Isaiah 40 there, you got the issue of a tent. That's what we're going to focus upon a little later on there. But the heavens spoken about is being spread again. Now, back here in Job 37, when Elihu's talking about the sky, it's not just the atmosphere around us, the first heaven that's in his view. Because he's talking about the sky being spread forth and being strong. And that's terminology, just like we looked at there in Isaiah 40, and just as we noted before in earlier on in Job, chapter 9, and chapter 26, of the pillars of heaven and stretching and spreading them forth. That's used in connection with the heavens as a whole. And the sky is oftentimes used to refer to the heavens as a whole. Come over very quickly to Hebrews chapter 11. Hebrews chapter 11. In referring back to what is described in Genesis chapter 15, when God told Abraham to look up into the heaven and to see the innumerable stars up there and to realize that so shall his seed be. Hebrews chapter 11. It says in verse 12, "Therefore sprang there even of one, and him as good as dead, so many as the stars of the sky in multitude, and as the sand which is by the seashore innumerable." The stars of the sky. Now, today we don't have a tendency to think of that, although we do still talk about it. He said, you look up into the nighttime sky. What I'm after is you appreciate the fact that Elihu, when he talks about the sky being spread forth and being strong, he's talking about the firmament of heaven. It's strong. That's one of the reasons why the firmament concept is used. It's not just spatial. It's got some strength to it. It's holding objects in it. Now, the foundations, the planting of the pillars, the fastenings and everything, some of that building terminology we saw there, you don't see those fastenings. But there are things, like I've spoken about later on in Job 3, about the ordinances of heaven. And they work in connection with keeping the stars and the planets, everything in their place. Well, that's why it's called a firmament, and it's got strength and everything to it. It's got substance and solidity and everything to it. Even though we would come along and talk about it as a vacuum and a void and all that kind of stuff, there's a lot of weakness in that understanding of things. This dispensation of grace continues on long enough, maybe science will start to make some catching up. But God says once again, as the one who's the creator, is far ahead of observable science. And there's great limitations, as we pointed out in the first lesson. There are things that cannot be known and cannot be understood, except the one who created it reveals it, because he's the one who knows why he did it. A lot can be understood by a lot of the what's and the where's can be answered just by observation, although even that's greatly limited. But the how's and the why's can't be answered but by the who did it. And those are some of the things we're looking at once again in connection with biblical earth science and astronomy. And we're not only looking at the who and some of the hows and gaining an appreciation for the whys, but that all's coming about by looking at it as God tells us to look at it. And he's the master communicator, and he's not communicating by language of accommodation and figures of speech and everything that have weakness and are detrimental to understand. No. He's communicating in the very way in which he wants you to understand. And it's fascinating. He doesn't stop using that terminology. When you get to the details and the prophets and the book of the Revelation, for example, Hebrews to Revelation as a whole, dealing with the end result of God's program with Israel and the establishment of his kingdom here on this, he's still using that terminology he used back in the Psalms and he used in Job. He doesn't change his view, but he doesn't come along and say, oh, you guys are so much smarter now by what you've learned and everything, I can come along now and talk to you about this differently. He doesn't do that. He still uses the terminology. He started off talking smart to you and I about this stuff. That's why he tells Job, gird up your loins like a man. I'm not going to baby talk you. I'm not going to talk down to you. I'm going to talk to you as the one who did all this. Now I'm going to talk to you as if you stood right beside me and watched all this whole thing take place. And folks, you want to be scientific. That's as scientific as you can get. Anyway, where are we here? Verse 18. Hast thou with him spread out the sky, which is strong? Once again, it's not just the atmosphere. He's looking at the whole thing out there. The heavens have been spread out once again. They're strong. They're that firm. They're holding objects in them. He gashed them and placed them and set them in their places and so forth. But it's really the last expression in verse 18 I'm after here now. He says, and it's strong and as a molten looking glass. Now you know what a looking glass is. It's a mirror. It reflects. Now, that's easy to understand when it comes to that first realm of the heaven right around us. I mean, light's reflecting off that all the time and everything. And we look up and we see blue sky when the clouds aren't there. And that the light's reflecting back. But the whole sky of the heavens is being looked at. And folks, that other barrier curtain out there to the second heaven functions like a mirror as well. And the light that is produced within the realm of creation, you're going to light-bearing body there, for example. Let that thing represent a star. It looks more like a black hole as far as the illustration goes, but producing light. Light's coming out of that thing. Some of that light goes out, hits the looking glass, comes back. I'm going to talk about new stars appearing to appear all the time. Science talk about the effects of the bang, the Big Bang, so to produce creation and everything, so to bring everything to existence. in microsystems, everything taking place out there, and this must be going on because new stars appear to be appearing all the time. Well, they got a whole bunch of problems with other things beyond that in their theory and everything. But if that thing out there, if that final barrier between the second heaven, the closed firmament of the heaven, and the third heaven is not only functioning as a curtain, but is mirrored on our side, then you're going to have light from the stars of creation hitting it, bouncing off. Eventually you're going to have bing, 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 and some of those bings are going to eventually come back to the earth in the center. But instead of a new star appearing, you're just kind of seeing the reflection off that mirror out there. Not only that, with that mirror effect out there, there's the illusion that it's endless going out there. You ever look into a mirror? I know you've looked into a mirror. They were looking into a mirror and just seeing that it reflects the infinity of space behind you. Most of the time we look in a mirror and we're concerned with just us in the mirror. That's how wonderful fleshly we are. We look in a mirror to see ourselves. You look in the mirror, though, and if you take your eyes off yourself for a moment and look at what's around you, you see the vastness of the space behind you. Now you get that mirror far enough away from you, and it appears like it just goes on, and there's no end to it. In fact, interior decorated men, they know that trick. You wanna give the appearance of much larger space in the room you're in, even though you're really not going to increase the space? Either put a big mirror on one of the walls or mirror the entire wall. And you'll get that illusion of endless space going off there. Well, man, folks, if that thing is as a molten looking glass, it just has the appearance that it goes on without end, immeasurable. There's a lot of ramifications to that, and a lot of answers to a lot of the puzzles and head-scratching business of scientific observation in connection with that. But my purpose right now in bringing it up isn't so much to talk about those things, though that was one of the purposes, but was also to tell us that that's something we need to understand. And there's some genius of God in connection with that. Surprise, surprise. If you think about what's going to take place when the Lord fulfills his plan and purpose for this earth and creation, which we're going to start talking about in a few minutes, with the earth, taking up his residence and everything on it, the light that he produces down here is going to emanate out from where he is. And it's going to keep on doing ding, 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 and all this kind of business. And that mirror effect out there will eventually end up with the realm of creation being all light. I simply say that to you now to indicate that there's some value in understanding this issue. And even though we don't really need it at the present time of our examination, I wanted to point it out. And it's something that Elihu and Job knew about. It's something that oftentimes Christians don't know about. Anyway, let's start to make some progress here now in some further details. Right now, I'm still letting the illustration be as it is. Let me get rid of that rogue star up here and its reflection issue. We don't need that at the present time. Eventually, I'm gonna finish off this thing, and we'll come down here. We'll end up with a spheroid type effect, but we're not in a position to deal with that just at the present time here. When we get over, like we were a few moments ago, to Isaiah chapter 40. God talks about sitting on a circle of the earth. And then we'll look at some passages in which he talks about how things are to be viewed from his perspective in the third heaven with respect to the earth. And he talks about that lowering parts of the earth concept. And really, when you get into the heart of the earth, as things are now, that's as far away from as low and as much of a descent as you can make from God and his realm on the outside. And so those things, plus some other things, help us to appreciate a spheroid type effect to all this. But anyway, we're not in that position for that yet, but I'm just telling you that to let you know that the diagram will be filled in as we move on here. All right. Back to Psalm 104, Genesis chapter 1. With what we have right now, we're in a position where I think we're going to be able to begin to focus upon the two particular realms that make up the creation, the heavens and earth of creation that we know of. We got the heavens. Right now, we'll simply talk about the second heaven. I talk about the kind of like the layering, rank territorial effect that's out there, and we'll deal with that. But I'm just going to talk about the realm of the heavens around the earth and the realm of the earth itself. And what we're going to do for now, as our study progresses on, is to begin to focus upon those two realms. And now we'll kind of split our study into biblical earth science for a while, and then we'll end up with the biblical astronomy issue, and then hopefully be able to put them both together at the end, and have this nicely tied up package. At least that's the intent. Anyway, Psalm 104, like I said, in the opening verses of Genesis chapter 1 here, we got this, the earth, in the midst of the heavens that he's created. And as soon as you begin to read beyond verse 1 there in Genesis chapter 1, the focus is on the earth. In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth and the earth. And really, the heaven, and outside of God talking about breaking it down into two major sections, open and closed, and garnishing it with some things, that those things that are spoken about as giving light on the earth and ruling the night and the day that the earth experiences and everything like that. But outside of that, the realm of the heaven with its two major sections that he doesn't say much about them in Genesis 1. The focus is going to be the earth. And naturally so, because he's writing his book once again for man that's created on the earth. But not only that, the earth is the focus in God's creation. The earth is the most important piece of real estate to God in his creation. And the reason why is because of his plan and purpose for the earth. And biblical earth science really begins right here. Biblical earth science isn't the issue of understanding what the earth is made of, necessarily, although some of those issues aren't excluded from it. Biblical earth science isn't the issue of understanding the breadth of the earth and so forth, even though that is not excluded from it. The key central issue in biblical earth science is, why did the Creator create it? What is it to him? The best piece of knowledge, the best piece of science you can ever have about the earth is to know why God created it. What's its purpose to him? What's he going to do with it? All right, let's start looking at that. Psalm 104, verse 2, once again, who covereth thyself with light as with a garment, who stretcheth out the heavens like a curtain, who layeth the beams of his chambers in the waters. All right. I've already told you, once again, my understanding and connection with that expression there as an amplification upon what is described there in Genesis chapter 1, verse 2, when it says, And the earth was without form and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep. And the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters. All right. God creates the earth in the midst of the heavens here and everything. The envelope of darkness is there. The earth, we're told, is without form and void. At the end of the 6 days, it's not going to be that any longer. But it starts out without form and void. And God deliberately started it out that way. It didn't become that. It says right there, and the earth was. You don't need to change the translation there or anything like that. It didn't become it. It was that way. And God deliberately started it off that way. And we'll deal with Isaiah 45. People come along and think it's not saying that. We'll deal with that. But it started out that way, and God deliberately started it out that way. Because he is going to do something with that piece of real estate right in the midst of creation there that's going to be it's going to be consistent with his plan and purpose for that creation. But he's also going to do it over a period of 6 days so that the angelic realm that's up there with him and everything, as they sing together, as those morning stars sing together, as they shout for joy over what's going on and everything, they shout for joy with comprehension. And by seeing him do what he does as he takes this earth and it goes from being void and without form to being populated and having a very particular form to it, as they see that, they understand what's going on and they realize what that piece of real estate's all about. And they realize why it's placed where it's placed. And they realize why the mirror is on the inside of the curtain. And they realize a whole bunch of other things. The end of verse 2 says, and the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters. God creates the heaven and the earth, and the focal point in that thing is this thing called the earth that's covered with water. And the Spirit of God, when he enters into the realm of creation that's just been created, it makes a beeline right for that planet in the middle. In fact, he doesn't do anything with the heavens yet. He doesn't divide them into the two sections. He doesn't garnish them yet or anything. He makes a beeline for that planet right in the middle. And the reason why is because that's the most important thing that's in that middle of the, in that creation. And what he begins to do begins to show to that angelic realm when the light is turned on what this thing's all about. Now, what's he doing? The Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters. Well, what's he doing? That's a pretty generic description. You can move in all sorts of ways. He's moving upon the face of the waters. We can get some help by looking at the verb here and everything and seeing how it's used in other places in the Scripture. There's all sorts of ways in which you can move. In fact, you can be moved in a figurative way, like you were moved to fear or moved to joy. You can talk about it in an emotional way, in which your thoughts and everything are moved in a certain direction. I'm just saying it to you to let you understand that the scope of the word is quite wide. Well, come over here to Deuteronomy chapter 32. Let's look at another time which this verb moved is used. Deuteronomy chapter 32. And let's look at it and notice the type of movement that's in view. Exact same verb. The type of movement that's in view here. Deuteronomy chapter 32 and verse 11. As an eagle stirreth up her nest, fluttereth over her young, spreadeth abroad her wings, taketh them, beareth them on her wings, so the Lord alone did lead him. And there was no strange God with him. This is the people of Israel, part of the Song of Moses. But God likens his actions unto an eagle in a variety of ways. But in one of those ways, he uses the same verb that's used back there in Genesis chapter 1, verse 2, for the Spirit of God moving upon the face of the waters. Notice in verse 11, as an eagle stirreth up her nest, fluttereth over her young. It's the verb fluttereth there. That's what the Spirit of God's doing back in Genesis 1-2. He's fluttering over the face of the waters. Now, what's that mean? He's flying all over the place and moving all over the whole planet and all that kind of business? Well, it may have started out that way. But just as the eagle here, it's fluttering over her young. Fluttereth is not a word that's used to describe the eagle flying around all over the territory. You got the nest is in view here. You got one particular spot in view. The nest is home to the eagle and her young. And the fluttering, that's what she's doing. That's her flying, brooding action over her nest and where her young are. Now that's the verb that's used back there in Genesis chapter 1, verse 2. And that tells us that the Spirit of God is moving on a very particular place on the face of the waters that cover this planet. He may have started out moving all, but he ends up in a fluttering over one particular spot. There's one particular spot on the face of the planet he's concerned with. And he does something in the waters that cover it. What's he do? Well, that's where Psalm 104 comes in. Psalm 104, once again, verse 3. Psalm 104, verse 3. Who layeth the beams of his chambers in the waters. Now, that's what the Holy Spirit's doing there. On the very first day of creation there, grace the heavens and the earth, brings them into existence, comes into the realm of creation, makes a beeline for the planet there, starts moving around the face of the waters there, it ends up fluttering over one particular spot. And the activity that goes on as he's moving upon the face of the waters there, fluttering over that particular spot, is a building activity. A building activity of a very special kind. Not just the building activity of the planet itself and setting it once again within the ordinance of heaven on its foundation so it doesn't move, but is the building activity on the planet itself. And he's laying, it says, the beams of his chambers. God through his Spirit is laying the beams of his chambers in the waters. Now he's not building the building right now. It's the beams of his chambers. His chambers, by the way, are up there with him in the third heaven. He's got this massive building complex up there with him that we'll talk about later on. And it certainly looks a lot better than that. He's got this massive building complex up there with him in the third heaven that he's been the builder and maker of. He drew up the plans for it. He constructed it. He used the materials that he had with him in the third heaven to construct it and everything. But his intention is to bring that thing down onto the earth. His intention is to set up his residence on the earth. The earth has been created by God to exist in the midst of his creation as the place of his residence in the midst of creation. And at a very particular spot on the planet, on the very first day of creation, the Holy Spirit laid the beams for God's chambers in the waters. Now, pick a pause here for a moment. Hold your place here. Come over to where we were a few minutes ago at the beginning of this lesson, Isaiah chapter 40. Yeah, Isaiah chapter 40, let's go there. Isaiah chapter 40, and where we were there in verse 21 and verse 22. I want us to have a look at some verses once again here now that underscore the fact that the plan and purpose of God is to set up his residence on this earth. Now, you understand God's program with Israel. That all clicks right away. That's not strange and foreign to you. But we're looking at now some of the intricate planning details in preparation and in expectation of that. And it started right on started right there on the very first day of creation, naturally bringing the earth into existence. But the very first day of creation, saw the Spirit of God enter into creation, start moving upon the face of the waters there, fluttering over a particular spot, then laying the beams of God's chambers, like driving pilings down into the waters, into the terra firma that was below the water there, and laying the foundation material there for His chambers, plural. Big building complex with rooms and everything like that to come down on. Isaiah chapter 40, verses 21 and 22. Now, we read these verses, like I said, a few moments ago in connection with appreciating the spreading out of the heavens along with the stretching them out of the curtain, spreading them out once again so that they function in a very particular manner with some strength to them, and they got some supports and everything in, that the pillars of heaven concept and that whole thing. Right now, I want you to look at these verses again and consider an issue that's spelled out that we didn't really look at last time, but now it's germane to our understanding. But also, before we do that, take a moment here and consider the context. This is really part of a rebuke to Israel through Isaiah at this time. The nation Israel is coming under the, or is being threatened with, worthy of, and it's being declared to them by Isaiah, that the fifth course of punishment is on its way. And Isaiah is given information about the how that fifth course of punishment is going to run, its various installments and all this kind of business. But as part of the rebuking indictment that God gives to Israel in connection with all this, they're wrapped up in idolatry to of such abomination and to such a degree that ignorance, total ignorance of the things that God had spelled out to them and His plan and purpose and everything is... It's what characterizes the nation, ignorant of the plan and purpose of God with them. And also, as they have been told the things that are going to happen, there's moaning and groaning going on and talking about the Lord's destroying His people and forgetting the covenant and all this kind of business. And in truth, they've destroyed themselves, as the Lord says, and they're the ones that forget the covenant. But as they do that, the Lord responds, and His reproving rebuke really starts here, at least in this section of Isaiah 40. It carries on for about the next eight chapters there, and it strengthens as it goes on. But it starts off here with the rebuke of Israel, as if haven't you understood anything even from the beginning? Can't you even look at the earth and remember what I told you I created this thing for in the first place, and your role as my nation in fulfilling that purpose? And yeah, you know, really, folks, when God comes along and says, "Can't you even remember the ABCs of what I taught you?" It's a stinging rebuke. And that's the situation Israel's in here. This is the ABCs of the knowledge God won. This is what they should have been learning in kindergarten type thing. They got to go back again. Anyway, I just want to say it to you, have an appreciation for it, have an appreciation for the way in which God says what He's going to say. Verse 21: "Have ye not known? Have ye not heard? Hath it not been told you from the beginning? Have ye not understood from the foundations of the earth? It is He that sitteth upon the circle of the earth, and the inhabitants thereof are as grasshoppers, that stretcheth out the heavens as a curtain, and spreadeth them out as a tent to dwell in, that bringeth the princes to nothing, he maketh the judge of the earth as vanity," and goes on and on there, and takes that off as the foundation for His rebuke and deals with Israel on the basis of that. But the things the Lord has to say in verse 22, it's as if Israel doesn't know these fundamental issues. It's as if they don't, they haven't understood from the foundations of the earth. They haven't understood from the description that's been given to them concerning what God did when He created the earth in the first place. When you get over to chapter 45 again, he'll hearken back to it, pull it up one more time, and he'll come along and say, "I didn't create the earth void and without form." And that's where people get the misunderstanding. They act as if what he's saying is, I didn't create it as it's described back there, and they got to read the rest of the passage and take it within its context. What he's saying is, I didn't create it to be left that way. He says, I created it to be inhabited, and the issue is by me. Well, look at it here, Isaiah 41. You gotta handle 41 before you get to chapter 45. Verse 22, "It is He that sitteth upon the circle of the earth, and the inhabitants thereof are as grasshoppers that stretches out the heavens as a curtain. That's the concept we're familiar with, and we went over that a few minutes ago. Spreadeth them out, and that issue. But notice he spreadeth them out as a tent to do what with? As a tent for some other people to dwell in? He spreadeth them out as a tent to dwell in. Spreadeth them out as a tent for him to dwell in. Ooh, now we're starting to get a little different perspective of things. As he creates and everything, as he exists out there in the third heaven, the heavens function as a curtain once again, preventing the light from coming through from the realm which he dwells in, preventing us from looking up there and seeing that realm and everything. The light that's even produced within here reflects back and everything and provides no capacity on that and gives a sense of vastness and everything that makes that realm where he dwells in seem almost so far off. You can't even imagine it. But now it's like he comes along and says, now, when I came in, that's exactly what he did on the very first day of creation. The Spirit of God entered in. By the way, he himself comes down, the second person of God, expressive member of God, the Lord Jesus Christ comes down on the sixth day of creation. He's there standing on the earth. He's standing there. And he plants the garden in Eden and everything. He puts his hand in the soil and we'll get to that kind of stuff. But he comes in, and now the perspective's different. When you're on the inside, he said, I spread this stuff out now as a tent to dwell in. This is, he comes in, and he's on the this is my I'm going to live in this place. And the heavens are going to be like a tent around. Well, a tent provides an envelope of residence around you as you're on the earth. And that's what he is. He's on the earth, and he's saying, look at the earth. This is the place of my residence, and the heavens out there have been spread out like a tent for me to dwell in. They're going to form the envelope of residence around me. By the way, you begin to understand some of these things and appreciate some of these things. You get an appreciation for the terminology he uses when as Job talks about him garnishing the heavens. We talked about that last time when we dealt with that passage. By his Spirit, he's garnished the heavens. When you garnish something like we talked about, you're really decorating it. You're beautifying it and everything. It's like, well, if the heavens are spread out like a tent to dwell in, they kind of form like the walls of the residence and everything like that. And you hang pictures on your walls. You paint the walls the color you want and everything. They produce the surroundings of your residential environment and everything. And you put things on them that decorate and that you like and are pleasing to the eye. And you garnish your residence with those things. And that's what God's done with the heavens. He garnished them. And that's looking at it from the from his residence on the earth. Well, see, that's what the earth is to me. That he created a piece of real estate in the midst of creation. He said, that's the piece of land I'm going to put my house on. That's what he did. And it's a very particular spot. Very particular place on this planet that he says that this is the particular place my house is going to be, my chambers are going to be. And the Spirit on the first day of creation is laying the beams for those chambers in the waters. The earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof, but there's a particular spot on it that he says I've chosen to dwell in. Come back to Psalm 68. Psalm 68. Now we're skipping ahead in the knowledge here by going to the 68th Psalm. The 68th Psalm is not going to do like Isaiah 40 did there and hearken back to what should have been known from the foundations of the earth. Psalm 68 is looking ahead. David's looking ahead here to the fulfillment of God's plan and purpose with Israel. And the very particular spot on the planet earth that God has chosen to put his house is within the border confines of the land God gave to Abraham and his seed. And David knew where that was. Not only the border confines of the land, he knew the very spot. He knew where the beams of the chambers were. Psalm 68. Now, I'm not saying this psalm tells you that David knew that. There are other things that tell you David understood and appreciated that. In fact, Abraham understood and appreciated that issue. And we'll have time to look at some of that as we go on. How are we doing here? Psalm 68. This is the 68th psalm. Is a psalm about the great and terrible day of the Lord. For opening verses, David sees the Lord riding upon the heavens and Israel's help there and everything. Exactly what takes place in Revelation 19 when he mounts the white horse and comes back. David sees the enemy scattered and all this kind of business. He sees the repeat of the judgments and the presence of the Lord that took place at Sinai there and the driving away of Israel's enemies and the vanquishing of them. Verse 15, the hill of God. Ooh, there's a particular hill that God says, mine. The hill of God is as a hill of Bashan, and high hill as the hill of Bashan. Why leap ye high hills, plural? This is the hill which God desireth to dwell in. Yea, the Lord will dwell in it forever. And there's a hill of God in the land of Israel that God says, I'm going to dwell there. I'm going to dwell there forever. And folks, the beams for God's chambers are at that hill. Come to two places here. We're going to have to bring this aspect of our lesson to a close. What we're focusing upon now, once again, folks, is the purpose of the earth. The fact that God created the earth to be his residence in the midst of creation. The fact that he's got a very particular place where on the very first day of creation, the Spirit of God is moving upon the face of the waters and was laying the beams of his chambers in the waters. All right, come over to Hebrews chapter 11, Ezekiel chapter 40. Hebrews chapter 11, Ezekiel chapter 40. We'll take Hebrews chapter 11 first. Abraham understood and appreciated God's purpose once again with the earth and God's purpose with him and his seed as God had delineated in the covenant he made with him when he called him out of Ur of the Chaldees. And as it's described in Hebrews chapter 11, is when Abraham entered into the land, having been called from Ur of the Chaldees, he entered with a tremendous amount of knowledge. More than you probably think he had if you just deal with Genesis chapter 15 and following there. Although if you read it very carefully, you understand Abraham had a tremendous amount of understanding. God communicated unto him details of the plan and purpose that he had for him and his seed. But Abraham comes into the land, and as it says here, verse 8, chapter 11, Hebrews, by faith Abraham, when he was called to go out into a place which he should after receive for inheritance, obeyed, and he went out, not knowing whither he went. By faith he sojourned in the land of promise, as in a strange country, dwelling in tabernacles with Isaac and Jacob, the heirs with him of the same promise. Why is he dwelling in tabernacles? Why didn't he set up a permanent residence there? Why didn't he come in and build a city? Why didn't he do what some of his forefathers had done? Why did he live in tabernacles? Why did Isaac go ahead and build a city? Why didn't Jacob go? Why did they do what some of the Gentiles, some of the sons of Canaan had done there, had already done, build cities and everything? Because Abraham understood that when he went into that land, he was going into a land God had chosen for himself. And there was a particular spot in that land that God said, I'm going to bring the city I have built down and put it on that spot. Abraham understood and appreciated that the original design for this earth that was set forth in the first 7 days of the earth's existence never got fulfilled yet. And that something took place that postponed God from bringing his chambers that are up there in the third heaven down onto the beams he had laid for them. And Abraham understood what that postponement was all about, what caused it all, why it was still in postponement. And he understood and appreciated that the covenant God made with him and his seed to be a great nation on this earth and everything was now going to be the mechanical means by which he would fulfill that original plan and purpose, plus some other things. And so when Abraham comes to this land, he doesn't come and build a city himself. He comes dwelling in tabernacles, mobile homes that move around. And he did a lot of moving around. And so did Isaac and Jacob with him. And the reason why they did that, verse 10 says, for he looked for a city which hath foundations, whose builder and maker is God. Now the issue is not that he entered into that city expecting to find it then, and he's looking all around it and was disappointed because he couldn't find it. That's not the issue. The issue is, that's what he anticipated. That's what he knew the land was all about. That's what he knew God's plan and purpose with him and his seed was all about. And that his permanent residence in the land would not be permanent residence in the land until that city came down. That city is a heavenly Jerusalem. But notice it's a city which hath foundations, builder and maker is God. And Abraham says that thing is coming to the earth. God had laid the beams for those chambers, but the city hadn't come down yet. Verse 13, these all died in faith, not having received the promises, but having seen them afar off and were persuaded of them and embraced them. Notice they saw afar off. Abraham knew. Abraham wasn't didn't come into the land expecting to find the city. He saw him afar off. He knew there's a time schedule involved in this whole thing. In fact, God gave him a 400-year time schedule to start the whole thing off. He was persuaded and embraced them and confessed they were strangers and pilgrims on the earth. For they that say such things declare plainly that they seek a country. And truly, if they had been mindful of that country from whence they came out, they might have had opportunity to return. But now they desire a better country, that is, a heavenly. Wherefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God. He has prepared for them a city. Now, people misunderstand that. They get the idea that what Abraham's looking for is to go to heaven. No. He recognizes that the land God promised him and gave him and everything, he's a stranger and a pilgrim, and while he's wandering around in it, he knows that until that city comes down and is on that piece of land, that piece of land is earthly country, suffering under the effects of the usurper and the curse. He's looking for a heavenly country, and the thing that's going to make it heavenly country is that God himself is going to bring his heavenly residence down onto the earth, put it in that country. He's going to dwell there, and it's his. That's what Abraham expects. See, Abraham knew the design and purpose of the earth. He knew it was to be God's residence. We're going to move here very quickly, and we'll be dealing with this passage a little later. Ezekiel chapter 40, verse 1. Ezekiel, and the visions that were given to him and everything, is taken by the Spirit into the end result of the day of the Lord and the beginning of Israel's kingdom with God's residence on the earth. And he sees, in the verse 1, the 25th year of our captivity, in the beginning of the year, in the 10th day of the month, in the 14th year after the city was smitten, in the selfsame day, the hand of the Lord is upon me and brought me thither. In the visions of God brought me he into the land of Israel and set me upon a very high mountain, very one God had chosen to dwell in, by which was the frame of a city on the south. You go through these eight chapters that end Ezekiel, and Ezekiel describes the land when the kingdom is established on and God sets up his residence on the earth and everything. And he sees the millennial temple there in the middle of the holy oblation and all this business, but he never sees the city. He sees the frame of the city on the south side of this mountain here. And he's able to describe the size and all that kind of business and portions and orchards and everything that are on the side of it. But he never sees the city. And the reason why is because the city is the one that Abraham looked for, his builder and maker is God, that comes down out of heaven and lands there. But Ezekiel sees the frame. The beams of those chambers have now been exposed. And he sees the frame. And then the city comes down on it. Folks, we're out of time for this lesson, and these things are exciting things, are fascinating things, and we'll be saying some more about them as we go on. But the issue right now is to appreciate the design and purpose of the earth. That's our focus now, the biblical earth science. And that very first day of creation, the Spirit of God's moving upon the face of the waters, and he's laying the beams of God's chambers in the waters there. And the issue is God setting up, preparing the earth for his residence. And the angelic creatures understand that. That's what they sing and shout about. And we're going to pick it up next time and start dealing with some of those issues and go on and see God change the earth from being void and without form to being populated and with the form he wants that matches his residence up there. Until next time.